Now it's going to sound really simplified, but people were mostly speaking about HVAC and light bulbs. And I was looking at the data and I was like, well, half of the emission is from materials. Why is no one speaking about that? And that really became the first step that drove me into these more, I'll call them the gritty, unsexy sectors. Right? I spent a bit of time with a few different mining companies looking at their water usage and decreasing water usage strategy. And what did that mean in terms of CO2 taxes and general business strategy?
Welcome back to the Clean Techies podcast, where we interview the top climate founders and VCs to get their best advice for you. In this episode, Silas and I chat with Liza Sandeman, founder and CEO of Pathways. Pathways is an AI platform that simplifies environmental impact analysis for the materials and manufacturing supply chain. I'm a built environment junkie, so this was really fun. Materials are the main cost driver of construction, which means they will be essentially the most difficult to decarbonize. Tools like Pathways make it easier to identify which materials will help maintain cost parity. Major potential for a big emitter like construction and the built environment to decarbonize as a whole. As always, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the episode. Also, please take a second to fill out our listener survey in the description or our Substack. We're eager to learn more about you, what you do, and how we can help. Now, back to it.
All right, welcome to the show, Liza. How's it going today?
It's going really well. I'm super excited to be joining both of you here in the new year.
Yeah, we're also very excited for this one. I think to give some context, we connected originally from the ERA demo day, and I just really like the pitch you guys have. It's really just quite fascinating in general, so super excited to get into it. But before we get into it, kind of just tell us, what are you doing today with Pathways in like one or two sentences?
Yeah, so we are building a software platform that enables material manufacturers to create their product level lifecycle analysis. So that's a lot of complex detail words from both prop tech manufacturing and climate. But if you look around in the room you're sitting in today, the paint on the wall, the brick, the wood, the chair you're sitting on, the window, any company that produces any of those material manufacturers, today they need to produce these lifecycle analysis. And they do it manually today. And we've developed a range of different softwares that enables them to do this based on their existing data. That's really what we're building on.
Shout out to our sponsors, Net Zero Insights. Net Zero Insights' mission is to enable the transition to a sustainable future by giving decision makers access to the leading market intelligence platform on climate innovation. Through the Net Zero platform, Net Zero Insights provides high-quality data and insights on the climate tech venture market by being the best at tracking organizations and funding rounds. I personally have had a great time using this to prepare for the podcast and researching companies, funding rounds, VCs, and the latest I need to know about the climate tech ecosystem. Use the link in our description to schedule your personalized demo with the team and claim your 10% discount. Thanks again to the Net Zero Insights team for sponsoring this show.
So when you say lifecycle analysis, can you explain that for people who may not be familiar with the built space?
Yeah, absolutely. Think of the chair you're sitting in right now, or if you're walking around your home, any furniture or any parts of your home, right? If you have a chair, it's going to have a bunch of different components. So if you need to create the actual product level lifecycle analysis, what you need are all the different input products, all the way down to the chemical input in the varnishes, the little metal stuffs, the wood that might be involved in it, right? Then you need to figure out how far was that transported, right? So you might have a chemical varnish that came from Malaysia that's transported to a little village site outside Ohio where your manufacturing plant is. You need to calculate that into the lifecycle analysis. And then ultimately, there's the manufacturer's own process. So do they have a fuel generator, an electrical generator? Which grid are they based on? How much water do they use? You can probably already figure out that this is mostly just a huge data challenge. Like, what are all these different size parts of information and how do I even get that? And that's what we build out technology that pulls this information directly from invoices, procurement information, the data lakes that hold safety information, really transforming the insights on the environmental level from months, which is what it takes today, to days and weeks.
It's really interesting to see the different methodologies that people are using
to estimate carbon and estimate the carbon life cycle. Some of them include not only the one that you're talking about, which is life cycle assessment, but science-based target initiatives is a very popular one. The philosophy there is 90% now. Don't worry about the 10%. That's usually where the hardest move is. And there's also GHG emissions protocol, which has their own methodology. A quick question for you is, why did you choose this methodology and how is it informed the design of your product?
Yeah, absolutely. So we lean up towards what's called the environmental product declarations. And it's one of the only third-party verifiable standards. It's also the standard that's used both across the EU, all European countries, and in the US. So there's a lot of resources and money put into how to measure something, right? Ultimately, the goal is to reduce. Right? That's what the climate challenge is. But the environmental product declaration and the underlying life cycle analysis at a product level doesn't just include global warming pressure, but a range of other biodiversity factors, which we think are super important, right? While carbon is king today, nature and the biodiversity loss is an incredibly important part of this challenge. So having a super standardized, third-party verifiable methodology that expands not outside carbon was really the three parts that were most important to us.
Can we get into that? How are you factoring in those other other emissions and other factors of the process? Because I think that some guests that we're excited to have in the future are, for example, talking about the difference between carbon dioxide and methane. Mm. And, right, different unfocused factors that are also a part of this life cycle. Mm. So can you get into where do you start thinking about these other factors and how do you quantify them?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of these other factors are exactly like you're saying. They can both be different emissions like methane or carbon, but they're also just chemical usages, right? That might have more localized biodiversity impacts. And because we're looking at building products, there's a lot of chemicals involved. I mean, it's kind of like the secret that people don't speak about, because why? You can't really see it, right? You don't look at your wall and you think chemicals. And chemicals are wonderful. I mean, they allow our walls to be durable. When we think about something like wood poles, which is a great product, replaces a lot of steel, that's coated in a range of chemicals so it doesn't burn. Well, those chemicals also have biodiversity and emission impacts. So I think really, I mean, the principle we've brought to this and that we're seeing manufacturers be excited about is it isn't always as simple as there's just one answer, right? And if you just narrowly focus on carbon, you might be missing out on your water usage, which in particular regions of the country are really more important. So that's kind of the part here. The other part is just the EPD framework has a range of factors. And again, we are not out here to reinvent a scientific framework. There are brilliant academics who do that every single day. What we're here to do is make sure that as many manufacturers as possible have the power to actually reduce their climate footprint.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because Soma and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort. And it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show. Yeah, I like this. So just kind of to summarize again, before we move on, I have some questions about your career. Is the manufacturers can use your technology to basically save a ton of time getting certain data that they're mandated to report, correct?
That's exactly right.
Perfect. Okay. So going back to your career, so you started in research, you ended up in consulting with McKinsey, and then eventually you decided to move to the States and do your master's. Can you just kind of talk a little bit, like what caused you to make that step? I want to understand your career journey a bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me really start at kind of the start of my career, which was in London at McKinsey, a big consulting house. And this was back when the Paris Agreement was our only climate framework in town. And from the get-go, I'd say I was at this intersection of sustainability and built environment. So I spent a bunch of time with a few different banks looking at their underwriting strategy and how to factor in climate into their investments or their underwriting in real estate and infrastructure. And now it's going to sound really simplified, but people were mostly speaking about HVAC and light bulbs. And I was looking at the data and I was like, well, half of the emission is from materials. Why is no one speaking about that? And that really became the first step that drove me into these more, I'll call them the gritty, unsexy sectors. Right? I spent a bit of time with a few different mining companies looking at their water usage and decreasing water usage strategy. And what did that mean in terms of CO2 taxes and general business strategy? And then I moved out to India to work with a big steel company. I guess that's kind of my materials point of no return. Right? I was standing in Jamshedpur and all I could see was steel. And it just really landed the both the size of the challenge, but also the need and the opportunity, right? What I met was super interesting, ambitious material manufacturers who really wanted to do better, but who ultimately were gatekept out of climate, right? Climate had become a little bit of this like elitist climate crypto or the center of excellencies. And I guess this mission about climate isn't sexy, right? It's barely interesting, right? It's infrastructure decisions. It's supply chain managers who swap out chemicals. It's plant managers who swap from fuel generators to electrical generators and enabling the people who are actually at the front line of climate mitigation to get information became really clear to me when I was standing out on those manufacturing sites.
Before we go too far, you brought up steel, and I think steel is one of the biggest themes of 2023. H2 Green Steel was, I think, the biggest climate raise. So I want to ask you really quickly, you were seeing this large, essentially landfill, or in all of your view, so much steel in front of you. What are your thoughts on green steel as a problem that you're tackling? Just, I want to talk about that for a quick second while we're there. Steel is very, very important right now. There's a lot of different methods, including recycled steel, which has its qualms because it's weaker. DRI, which is direct reduced iron steel, which, of course, as you know, like I'm really passionate about the built environment, that has more potential, but it's very nascent. So just your thoughts on there. Was it the potential of its steel? Was it something you saw? What actually about that got you catalyzed?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I'm by no means a steel expert, right? And there are people who are deep in whether it be electric arc furnace, the shares of recycled steel, how you can use it, the construction structure, the strength of it. But what really hit me, I guess, living out in India were two different parts, right? The first is a lot of these products are phenomenal products that enable a lot of people to get safe, good infrastructure and housing, right? The next 30 years are going to be our biggest global urban expansion. We're going to build more the next 30 years than we ever have in human history. And everyone deserves good, safe housing and good, safe infrastructure, particularly as climate change is increasing and adaptation and actually building out better infrastructure is becoming key. And I think what I saw was so a lot of these materials that get, I'll say, kind of quote unquote vilified if you look at the news cycle. But the reality is, you can transport steel very easily. You can build out structures. And when you stand kind of outside somewhere like Mumbai and you're looking at what housing stock is needed, steel is certainly part of the solution. So that's kind of one angle, right? Then the other angle is, well, urban environment is already 40% of global emission. As we electrify, materials themselves are going to be the single biggest contributor to biodiversity loss and climate change. So putting in efforts and resources to develop and expand production methods, supply chains, combination choices for some of these core materials, I think is really important. And I'm super excited by everything I'm seeing, whether that be kind of, you know, some of Heidelberg's work with lower carbon cement, steel alternatives or recycled steel inputs. I mean, we need new materials as well. And a lot of the new material innovation is phenomenal, but there's just not a silver bullet when it comes to construction.
I resonate with that. One of my, yeah. And I think I'm hearing that in what you're saying. So
no, you're totally, I mean, that's really at the core of it, right? When we talk about materials and wood and steel and cement and glass, right? They're the components that build up a house. So I'm Danish by a background. I like to make Lego analogies. I mean, a house is the sum of the bricks, right? That's the same if we want to decarbonize the actual materials. You've got to start at the brick level. But once you've summed up all those bricks, those become homes, right? They become the offices we work in, the spaces we feel safe, and people deserve access to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really interesting. I like this. So going back to when you decided to do your master's, right? When you made that decision, were you planning to, you know, build a company? Like, why did you decide to do that rather than try to get another job and something else that, where you can make an impact? Like, tell us more about that.
Yeah, so between working in consulting, I actually had a step in between. So I knew I wanted to start building things. So I joined a social enterprise in the recycling space, in the material recycling space, also out in Southeast Asia in Indonesia. And help scale up a team from around 8 people to 30 people. And I just loved it, right? I think that there is something about the opportunity to build new companies, solutions that work for people and work for companies that just, frankly, was just like super exciting for me personally. And but I also knew that it wasn't something I wanted to do alone. I wanted to find a co-founder, and I wanted time to really iterate and speak with potential customers before just jumping in and kind of coming up with ideas, right? I think this whole thing about you come up with an idea, right? It doesn't exist. Like you listen to enough pain points and you listen to your customers, and that's how you develop what your product and your solution is. So that's really what brought me to the US and to do a master's. It was wanting that space and time to really explore and test and make sure that my next steps in my career were where I could add the most value personally.
And did you specifically choose the area you went to because of your interest in the built environment? Because, I mean, Boston is pretty well known for a lot of deep tech innovation. Was that intentional or just kind of by happenstance?
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest, it was probably more the university. Right, the Harvard MIT ecosystem is just a phenomenal hub for entrepreneurship, for innovation, had a real climate focus and had a real angle of built environment. And I knew that it was going to be something within biodiversity and climate and built environment. But I mean, built environment is huge, right? It's everything from HVAC installation to material development, hard science, software. And I hadn't decided or nailed down where were the biggest needs for me to solve.
Let's double tap on that. What about the Harvard MIT ecosystem was really, really beneficial about the built environment?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, there are just some real thought leaders there, right? I think of kind of the MIT real estate institute, right? The bringing together expertise. The Suffolk is really closely connected, right? Bringing together expertise from construction, from material manufacturers, from real estate developers, Boston Properties just down the road, together with innovators who are trying to figure out from an academic perspective, how do we actually deal with some of those challenges? And I think, I mean, a lot of these things happen in osmosis, right? And once we really got our hands, me and Alex, my co-founder, on the challenge of embodied carbon, in whether it be kind of in architecture, in construction, real estate, everyone was talking about embodied carbon, which is, you know, the carbon of the real stuff, the materials. Then it became more a question of who in this value chain really has the power to solve this. But it was that kind of osmosis, the things you can't put a word on, right?
Yeah. So this is, you know, the story of people coming to build companies is like people underestimate how difficult it is to find a co-founder to do something with. So can you just talk like very briefly about kind of meeting Alex and deciding to do this together? And then I want to get into how you came up with which idea to pursue.
It's so hard to find a co-founder, right? It's I mean, I spend more time with Alex than I do with anyone else in my life, probably than I ever have with anyone else. And we're pecking everything together, right? You put your career together, you get annoyed at each other, you get inspired by each other. It's all the range of emotions. I actually went about this in a I'd say, relatively structured way. I knew I wanted to explore and test out with a lot of different people. So I'll say my first year, I did a lot of what I'll call co-founder dating. I basically wrote to all the PhDs in the MIT Harvard ecosystem that I thought had really interesting ideas. And I asked if they wanted to grab a coffee. But most of them didn't want to start companies, right? Like, you need to find not just someone you match well with, but also someone who is actually willing to take the crazy jump that it is to build your own thing. Right, it certainly isn't straightforward. Me and Alex ended up meeting in an MIT class at Sloan called New Enterprises. From the get-go, I think we thought there's something here. Like, we started working on this more as a project, and with two other people as well. Then we started, you know, pretty slowly being like, well, this feels like there's something here. What could we make out of this? Started discussing what would it even look like to build a company together. And then we actually set quite tangible milestones. So every 3 months, what do we need to believe at this next stage for us to feel confident in this? And we started having systematic feedback every month for almost a year until we kind of took the final jump, saying, well, what's working well in our collaboration, what's not? And then we rolled into it.
Mm-hmm. And so that was primarily on determining whether or not to work together, correct? That wasn't about the idea specifically?
Yes.
Yeah. So
working together.
So obviously you mentioned it earlier, right? People think, oh, I have this idea, and that's just the general idea is, oh, I just had this idea and I went for it. But what did you toss out, right? There's a lot of things that were probably like really close you were thinking about pursuing, but then you're like, no, we're not going to do that. So talk about the process of figuring out which idea to pursue and some of the main kind of runners up.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, the list of bad ideas is so long, right? Which is why I think you have to really like who you're working with, because ultimately it's all about product market fit, and you keep iterating, right? It's not like you get to a point where you don't think about product market fit. Like, I wake up thinking about product market fit. I go to sleep thinking about product market fit. So what were some of the run-ups? Well, we were really focused on this idea of embodied carbon in the built environment, right? The half of the 40% that comes from the materials. But there were roughly four different types of people you could target. You could target the real estate developers, the architects, the construction, all the material manufacturers. We actually spent a lot of time speaking with people in all these four buckets, right? Real estate developers, really understanding if we were to build something that helped them reduce the footprint, what would that look like? We started building up a solution in the architect space, pulling together all the data from these different EPDs and environmental intensity factors and seeing how you could model it as a building. But pretty quickly found out, one, there was a lot of competition in that field. And two, architects don't have a lot of money to spend. And in many ways, they sit in the middle being pulled from all different sides. So while they are phenomenal thought leaders, it's very hard to change the world from that point of view. And ultimately, we knew what our North Star was, which was reducing climate footprint.
I think the architect focus is incredibly relevant because a major barrier for the built environment is getting these newer technologies into designs that are then passed on to developers and then construction managers and things like that. And there's a major roadblock with technology risk, which is for the architect, their main incentive is, will this work? And their bias towards going with older, less decarbonized technologies designs is that I know this is going to work.
Yeah.
And so I think there's not only the financial constraint, but also the risk that they're not willing to take on. And I think what you pointed out is a problem that I'm thinking about actively, which is, I think, how do you incentivize, you know, this group at the very inception? I think there's also been an explosion recently of architect design software, mm-hmm. especially for the built environment. And I think that's tackling the same problem of making it more efficient and less friction based to iterate on these designs. One question I had for you then is, you know, thank you for letting that out. What led to the impetus of, you know, wait a minute, this idea, Pathways, has ground, has traction?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, Sunil, I think you're just spot on with everything you're saying there, right? It's so absolutely critical. And I speak with architects who say, well, I don't know how to read this 30-page long environmental product declaration. And it's not giving me it doesn't even say the footprint of a window. It says the footprint of a square feet of glass. Like, how am I gonna measure anything based on this? So there's definitely a lot of problems there. When we were speaking with real estate developers, with architects, with people in construction, they kept saying the same thing over and over again. There's a lack of data. We're just missing information about this. Well, we would choose differently if we just had more of this information. And it felt like all the arrows were pointing to the material manufacturer. And I mean, I think a natural question from that is, well, why don't we have this information? Why don't we know more about how these materials are produced? That's when we really started speaking with a lot of material manufacturers. And it was just shocking, right? You meet these really great people who've been working often for generations in different materials, who were suddenly faced with new requirements about having to produce these documents that they hadn't known about for life cycle analysis, lots of information needed from their suppliers, transportation, their own processes, really outside the scope of what their teams had ever done before. And when the only solution they then had was, and largely have today, is to go to very expensive consultants who come in, do all this manually. Best case, they read it directly off your invoices and off your data system, which is expensive and take a long time. Worst case, you get given a custom Excel that you can send to all your sub-suppliers, and then you have to wait for them to send it back, right? And that was just a huge pain for material manufacturers. And we knew, I mean, Alex comes from a data product background, having been at Uber, 2Chess, Clutter, building out product and data structures. And I'd spent a long time in sustainability with this challenge. We knew this was something technology could tackle. And ultimately, summing up 10,000 invoices and 15,000 rows in Excel isn't meant to be a human task. Like, that is a technology challenge. And that really became the start of Pathways.
Yeah, this is great. I like that. With the one question I have is, with the EPDs, is this a regulation, or is this just like a self-regulated situation that the industry has put itself into? Because I've not heard any particular news about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the exciting thing about the built environment, I mean, it's a good and a bad thing, is when it comes to embodied carbon, most of the regulation doesn't make the front lines of the news. Right? People just are not interested in material intensity. There is a bunch of regulation requiring EPDs, right? If you want to be bidding for any of the Inflation Reduction Act, I mean, the biggest infrastructure spend in US history, you need an EPD if you're building in something like steel or cement, right? Yeah. If you want to be selling into California or any of the more progressive regulatory areas, you need these environmental product declarations. So while it's not something that makes the front pages of the news, ask a material manufacturer and they sure know what it is. Because they cannot sell their products if they don't have these documents increasingly. And it's the same across the EU. Interesting. It's an interesting piece of legislation that, again, isn't sexy or flashy, but it's working.
Got it. Okay. And then the last major question I have is, you talked a little bit about there was a too much crowd. It was a crowded space with one of the ideas you had. How do you go about determining if a space is too saturated with other, you know, similar technologies?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two different parts, right? That's like, how much value could we add here? Again, we think we're building something that's a billion-dollar opportunity here, right? Because the need is so huge. But ultimately, the North Star is the climate impact we can have. And the challenge, if it's a really crowded space, is also you can't have the impact you actually want to have. In this space, we just haven't seen a lot of interest or innovation, right? Material manufacturers are mostly being given software that looks like something out of the 1990s. I don't know who's chosen that material manufacturers don't deserve good software. Like, apparently they're not allowed to have nice UX. Right? So that's just one challenge. The other part is that people don't want to work with hard-pressed wood or steel or glass manufacturers. But they're lost because we love working with material manufacturers. Mm-hmm. So it is probably just back to it's less sexy and people are less interested.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. We don't have to go into it at this point, but the topic of timing and, okay, you know, there was a lot of people who piled into the ESG tracking space, right? The ESG data tracking space. And It's just super, super saturated at this point. And if people would have looked around and done a little bit of research, they would have realized that before building. But if you're also too early, it's really difficult. So I think it's, you know, it's always about getting that timing right. But if you have any comments, I'd like to move on to another topic.
Well, we can jump on, but it looks like Samuel, you're going to say something.
No, I think I just wanted to double down on that, saying that it's not only timing with ESG. I think we can use this to segue. There's also timing on built environment. Local on 97, some laws passed in Boston. Seattle just committed to, I think, zero emissions by 2030. There's a lot of movement in the built environment space, mainly driven by regulation. One thing I want to zoom out on is that in a recent CTVC article, which might be like we quote them every other episode, industry actually came into the third most funded category, I believe, and then don't quote me on that, but it had some sort of historic rise. And so I think there's this dichotomy between maybe what used to be built environment and industry, which is, you know, rather neglected, underinvested. But honestly, in my day-to-day, like in venture and seeing deals, I do think industry is gaining momentum. I want to directly contrast this with one of your posts talking about, you know, built environment, people aren't really paying attention. I think there is a bit of like an echo chamber here. People who care, people who don't. But I think it's growing. And I think it's growing partly, and if not mostly, due to regulation. I just want to ask really quickly, what is your gut feeling today, maybe compared to when you first started Pathways, about the built environment?
Yeah, I mean, from the time I started being interested in built environment, people were like, what is built environment, right? I mean, I speak also with funds who did prop tech certainly before it was sexy. I still think that built environment has these kind of four different angles, right? There's been a lot of attention on tenants and real estate developers. I don't hear a lot of people talking about hard pressed wood or ceramics, right? So even within the built environment, there's of course variation, as there always is within a space. But the amount of startups, exciting technologies, innovation is extremely promising, and frankly, just very exciting to be in, right? Because my experience is that these different companies and the people who work in the built environment also have a lot of appetite. They know they wanna be part of the solutions of digitalizing, of being more climate friendly and creating safer, good spaces.
I definitely agree with that. I think there's certain technologies that are now getting off the ground. Timber is one of them, I think you mentioned. I think the real difference here is what's like, you know, I think low carbon capture concrete, for example, is now, you know, firm, like really solidified within the built environment. So I definitely understand the striation that you're talking about. The next sort of like big picture topic within the built environment that I'd love to push you on is different types of buildings and decarbonization. So one thing I'm wondering is, what was the easiest type of building to decarbonize for you? And what is sort of like the big, and decarbonize in the sense of estimating the, you know, different life cycle analysis, exactly, things like that. And a building that is a building style that's particularly challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing there is our customer is the material manufacturer. So in many ways, when we talk about decarbonization, people think of the whole building, right? But back to this Lego analogy, you don't decarbonize all the Lego bricks together, right? Each of the bricks need a different approach. So when we think of what are the materials or the areas where there's a lot of opportunity, I mean, combining that with design, any building that's already standing is better for the environment, right? Every time we take down a building and rebuild it with something new, doesn't matter how sustainable the materials you're rebuilding a new building with are, that's worse for the environment, right? So the other part is extremely frequent retrofits, or every 2 to 3 years an office block basically gets all the interior ripped out, new carpets, new paint, new wall, fully new setup, right? These are things that I call kind of like the hidden emission, right? Because tenants will think about the fact that the light is on or the heat because they receive a bill every single month, but they won't think about the amount of emission that goes into that retrofit. So this is a little bit of a sideways way of answering your question, less about which buildings and more about the approach, right, and the type.
Within the space, which are the technologies that you notice is on the material side that are getting a lot of attention or have the most kind of innovation going on? And which are the ones where you say, listen, like we haven't seen anything interesting happening to decarbonize this material?
It's a really interesting question and something we spend a lot of time looking at. I think in general, I mean, I think there are two different streams to this, right? There is innovating and updating the process for existing materials. That's something like when we talk about new methods of cement or concrete or steel, right? It's really about taking materials that people know how to use and innovating so that their climate footprint is ultimately lower. But then there is this other side, which is how to actually develop new materials that have kind of different footprint. I think some of the areas I find really exciting are insulation, figuring out how to make insulation more green and an alternative material combination. Another one that's really on biodiversity and chemicals is carpets, right? Carpets and tiling. Like the people who are trying to figure out how to have new adhesives that have a lower footprint. Again, here, they're like, it's back to this big thesis of like climate is technical, right? It isn't flashy. It's the adhesive between the carpets that you put in a new building and how to rip it off and what happens if you burn it. And then, of course, I think that a lot of what's happening in wood, and that's also a place where US is really leading. A lot of housing in US is built on a lot of wood, which, if done right with sustainable forestry, can be a carbon storage. Right, it's a phenomenal product. But figuring out how to use that in combination with other materials, there's still some way to go.
I think I want to jump in really quick. Insulation is a very, very exciting topic for me. There's a lot of cool companies doing work in this space. Hempstone is one. Wanda House is another, I think, in Germany. A lot of bio-based insulation products. One thing I want to ask is, on that, you talked about a lot of things that are cool, maybe getting more attention, should be getting more attention. Do you think more people care about this now than they did when you started? And if so, why? And if not, why not?
I think in the industry in general, there's been an awakening of we have power, we can do something about this, right? So it's always a question of like, which people do you need to care, right? It's really hard for everyday consumers to have impact on how the carpet adhesives in their office building is made, right? So the people you need to care are the industry groups, the companies that kind of are leading in the spaces. And I think that is an area where regulation has been incredibly powerful, like actually requiring some of these environmental product declarations, building transparency, the work Stacey Smetler has done with EC3. I mean, just driving transparency so that companies can compare themselves to each other, seeing, oh, damn, my product underperforms by 20%. Why is that the case? I think these moves are things that have left people caring more. But I also do think that there's something about, I call it like democratizing the access to climate, right? But this idea that climate is a real thing, that material manufacturers, that people out on the manufacturing floor can do something about, right? It isn't an ivory tower. It's really, they're the ones who have the power to make the change. And I think that's still a challenge, like speaking with people and reminding them that they are the ones who can make the differences and building software and products with them as the core user, because they are really the people who can decarbonize heavy industry.
This is maybe just a bit of speculation, but I kind of wonder if part of the reason why there's a lack of interest is because I come from a state where there's a ton of manufacturing. The Midwest manufactures a lot of things generally, right? And you don't hear about manufacturing companies. Like, even when you live in the town where there is dozens and dozens of manufacturing companies, you don't hear about them. So they kind of move in silence. They're not like these big corporates who have massive PR teams and stuff like that. So do you think that might be just out of speculation, part of the reason why nobody's trying to build tech to help them because they haven't made like essentially an RFP for this technology?
I think you're totally right there. I mean, one of our first customers is a $3 billion hard-pressed wood manufacturer, right? That very few people know about. They make 1 million utility poles a year. They're really innovating on a lot of things within this space, and we're helping them do it. But they have a hard time even attracting talent, getting people who can solve these problems. And I think you're right, Alice. I mean, why do people not pay attention to this, right? It is because it's maybe seen as boring and unsexy. That's good for us. We think they're sexy and interesting. So, but I think there's a lot of opportunity to develop tech in these fields.
I was going to say earlier, yeah, you had mentioned that it's not a sexy industry, but like if you're an innovation junkie like myself, it's super interesting. I love this like deep science, because that's the whole, like, that's kind of the main reason why I'm became super interested in climate, is because it required everything my first thought was everything we use, the materials, the hard materials have to be reinvented from a chemistry perspective, right? It probably goes back to when I was like 12 or something. There was this guy who was a chemist and kind of explained and opened my mind to that. I was just like really fascinated by it. But kind of going, I want to get some more details about the company. So you know, the technology, we understand what it does. You help them save time, you help them save money by getting this EPD data. And I want to understand just like high level summary, like how does it work? What does it look like for implementation? How long does it take, et cetera? Just walk us through that.
Absolutely.
Process.
So let's get back to these three different sources of data we need. The supplier information, the transportation information, and then your actual manufacturing process. So our platform, the integration side of it is really pulling this data. The vast majority of this, and that frankly was a pretty big surprise to me, exists within data lakes of these companies, right? You just need to know where to look and how to look. So some of the innovations we're, for example, applying are using large language models to pass through unstructured invoices and pulling out that documentation, right? So for a good example of that would be one of our customers. Their electricity still comes has an analyst sitting and downloading invoices from a website in a PDF format and then typing them into an Excel, right? When we talk about getting data, like that's some of the formats. Those are parts where we can apply a combination of, really like data structure, large language models to pass through and input that information. The other part is just directly from procurement system and safety documentation. So material breakdowns of sub-suppliers often have to be reported in safety information. So when we think about what does implementing for a big material manufacturer look like, it's really us sitting on top of their data stack, pulling the information needed for the lifecycle analysis. Then the second part is, what does the customer look at? Right, and I think that's where we can talk about the differences with a lot of the technologies they use today. Because what we've really built is a super simple platform that allows them to see that life cycle analysis on a product-specific level, sum up across different types of products, compare them, and then get really simple overviews of the hotspots. Like, what's driving the environmental emission of this product? That's the kind of insights that then allows supply chain managers, procurement teams, operations teams to decarbonize. But also, we were speaking with a sustainability manager who said, wow, this is actually, third-party verified and rigorous and bottom-up. We can ultimately use this to just communicate our climate footprint of our whole company. Like, a material company is just the sum of the products, right? So so I think that's some of the use cases we're seeing now.
Something that you mentioned that really sticks out to me is, having done a lot of recruitment in the ESG and sustainability, kind of a lot of the reporting world, is it's usually when those people are speaking to a lot of their corporate, like just the people who run the company, right? The regular people, they are like, it's like speaking in tongues to them. They have no idea what's going on, right? This is like the secret language, right? But if you can just make it super digestible for the average person, then the whole company can be like, oh, this makes sense. How can we decarbonize the transit, right? How can we decarbonize this? It's super simple, super easy to understand. And if we're going to actually decarbonize the entire industry, you have to make it that way, because you don't have the average person working in these companies. It's not somebody who comes from some type of like elite circle and thinking about like sustainability on a high level. It's not philosophy. It's driven on like, I want to make good products. And they're in, especially if like in the Midwest, like they're probably like really focused on family values. Like, I'm just here to have this job because I want to like have a good life, right? And I think that communication aspect is something that is massively lacking across the industry.
Well, honestly, I could not agree more with what you're saying, right? And that's back to this idea of like democratizing this information. It doesn't have to be as complex and as hard, right? That's part of the like gatekeeping by sustainability consultants. Make it sound really difficult, elitist, hard to do. I'm like, If you say another chemical is 25% less less biodiversity impact, like everyone understands that. And someone who is mainly a manufacturing manager but now has 10-15% responsibility, which is sustainability, that's suddenly something they can act on. And that's if you want to make real change, you got to meet people where they are. Like, can't meet them where you want them to be.
So this goes really well into my next question. You've told me a story about this, so I have inside information on this. But can you talk about landing your first customer? I want to know, you know, first of all, how did you – I'll get into a particular question about the story you have. But how did you identify them, and how did you actually get the meeting and land that first conversation that led to a customer?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I'm sure is going to resonate with a lot of other founders and probably also early stage VCs, there is it's a mix between grit, hustle, and luck, right? And then a lot of listening, right? So our first customers have all been landed on cold outreach, right? So a combination of frankly just picking up the phone and calling sales execs at big material manufacturing companies. They have their numbers online, and LinkedIn outreaches. I probably don't need to tell you guys that material manufacturers don't exactly live on LinkedIn, right? but the advantage of these kind of very accessible tools to everyone is that you can see the roles and titles of different people in the organizations. You can get an understanding of what do they care about, what do they say. Our first sales were really converted in a few weeks, right? Which when you talk about big public companies, isn't super common. But the core here is listen to what people are saying. Like, you know, they will tell you what their pain point and their problem is if you listen. We've targeted these, I call them kind of mid-sized material manufacturing companies, and got a bunch of strategy that I'm not gonna, you know, talk loudly on a public podcast, but at the core of it is empathy, hustle, and a fair amount of grit, right? It's a lot of business.
Yeah. Yeah, so this leads to the story you told me that's just like I really resonates with how I imagine the space to be. How receptive are these people to hearing what you have to say, right? Because like you don't necessarily think of manufacturing people as like out there usually, you know, banging the sustainability drum. So can you talk about that and your stories on that?
Yeah. Well, let me give an anecdote and then we can figure out if we want to cut it out later. So I was on a call with a steel producer in the Midwest, and I'm also now going to get a lot of flag for a horrible American accent, but let me kick it off, right? So we start out the call here, and he says, Liza, I don't know if I like you got your pronouns on your email, right? So it's fair to say that one could think there's a little bit of distance between me and this the CEO of the steel company. I was feeling in a jolly good mood that day, so I said back, if that's our biggest problem, we're going to do just fine, right? And he came out with a big laugh, and then we got on to talking about what our product actually does, right? This is a guy who I certainly am not sure we stand the same place politically. We don't come from the same background, don't come from the same part of the country, but he also is facing the pressure about producing environmental product declarations, about decarbonizing his product. He sees it as a real good sales opportunity to have lower carbon footprint and being able to communicate that in a verifiable way. And he knows good business when he sees it. I mean, consulting services are expensive. If we can do it with product and software, that's much better. And again, you know, let's see if this makes the final end of the
I love this. No, this has to stay in. This is such a great story.
But it's just to say that, again, like, if you want to be building something in this space, you can't only speak with people who see the world or think like you do or who you think have the same values. Like, you got to be meeting people where they are. Like, that's how we shift things together. And that's very much at the core of, like, my beliefs, me and my co-founder, Alex, how we build our company, the types of people we're hiring, the way we're building our product.
Yeah. No, I think this is, again, this goes back to the communication aspect, but I'm from the Midwest, so I generally, you know, I understand how these people think, and the language and the communication that's used with climate and the mainstream media, the way they push it out it is very, very off-putting to those people, right? And this is the thing, is if you genuinely want to decarbonize industry, which is, again, the hardest, industry and built environment generally, like materials, you need to understand the other person's, what matters to them. It's all about sales, right? In sales, you have to understand what do they actually care about and want to achieve. And if you want to achieve your outcome, align with their outcome, right? And that's all of the most successful founders who have come on the show have done that. So without getting too much more into that, I do want to know just kind of, I think the last major question about the company so far is, what has been the biggest challenge to this point?
I mean, I think we're in a funny time with startups, right? There's a lot of talk about climate startups doing well, prop tech contact, but there's been a difficult fundraising environment. It's been kind of an overall economic environment where even companies are worried about making investments. There's a lot of political discussion about, well, what's going to happen at kind of big elections coming up. In many ways, we're sheltered from it because a lot of the regulation that impacts us is much more local and is also much more entrenched already. But I think holding constant throughout all of that if you're really listening to what's the pain point of your customer and you're building good products for them, you can weather all those different things, right? And then, you know, both me and my co-founder are first-time founders, right? Which means that we wake up every day and make like 10 different mistakes and most things we don't know. And leaning on good advisors, but also knowing that it's been done before a lot of times. So why shouldn't we be able to do it?
Yeah, and kudos to you. I think part of being at the pre-seed stage, the early seed stage, is not only finding a problem and validating it, but finding people who are willing to invest in your belief in the problem. So one thing I want to transition to before we end the episode is, you know, for the audience right now at the time of recording, this has not gone live. It will be by the time that this episode goes live. So I don't think we're spoiling anything. What announcement would you like to share with our audience today?
Well, you know, this makes me smile big. You're absolutely right. I mean, the best thing is getting people along on your journey, right? And that goes for team members you hire, but certainly also investors who back you. So we kicked off a fundraise just at the end of 2023, and just before the holiday season, closed a heavily oversubscribed round. So we planned out to raise 1.5 million. We ended up closing 2.5, had almost 4 million committed to the round. So kind of a dream scenario when you think of kind of excitement round dynamics and getting people on board. And from the get-go, me and Alex had really wanted to get two types of funds on board. Ones that know our customers super well, construction tech, prop tech, and second, climate funds. And our round is led by Sakura and Pi Labs, a US-based construction and prop tech fund, and a London-based prop tech fund, which is great because it gives us that European footprint. And let's be honest, Northern Europe, a lot of innovations are happening. So it's just a great place to be. And then a coalition of funds coming in, joining us, and yeah, I mean, I couldn't be more excited and very, very happy.
Yeah, congratulations to you. I mean, this is also for context. I mean, 2023 was not necessarily a stellar fundraising year. There's a lot of concerns about capital going in. I will say, I think people are more optimistic about the pre-seed and seed stages, but I still think hats off to you to be able to do that, you know, given the kinds of headwinds we're seeing within the market. One of the things I want to ask is, for your round, you know, we were talking about this leading up to the show and you're being very humble about it. You had a very oversubscribed round. So what do you think really attracted multiple people, not just a couple people that believed in your vision? There's clearly something broader reaching about what you're doing. And what do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a few different things, right? I think the first is really knowing the customers you speak with. Right. So we already had the first couple of customers signed on even before we developed our product paying us. Right. So being able to show that what you're building is valuable enough that they want to go on board. I think the second is is kind of like more of a fundraising tip, right? A lot of this is also quantity, right? We ended up having 7 funds join this round with 2 big checks and then a range of kind of smaller positions, but spoke with probably 60, 70 funds, right? And there are just so many venture funds out there. A lot of people kind of only know a few big flashy names that are mainly known for kind of Series A, Series B. But when you go out and you speak with a lot of different funds, you also learn a lot about which kind of funds match your timelines, your focus. Do they have other companies in their portfolio that are actually really complementary to what you're doing? And then intros, right? I could shout out my good friends at Tangio off to. I mean, so many introductions from other founders, and at least half of our round ended up coming from intros from other founders that, frankly, like me and Alex have just met by going to events, speaking with people, writing on LinkedIn, and being honest and collaborative. So that was just, I mean, that's such a nice thing.
How did you navigate having an oversubscribed round?
Yeah, I mean, it's, first of all, it's a huge privilege and a luxury, right? To get to be in a position that you get to kind of negotiate on allocations and who to have in. I mean, there are funds that we really like, but who also play at later stages and where it might not make sense right now, but that doesn't mean it couldn't make sense at some point. I think the other part is chemistry and fund mix, right? Like ultimately these are people, I mean, it's going well right now, but it's definitely going to go bad at some point, right? It does for all startups. So who do you want on your side, not just when things are going well, but also when you're struggling and it's difficult and there's something you can't figure out. And that really became a kind of a premise for who we brought on at this early stage.
This might be like a really nuanced point and maybe not relevant, but I am curious when you mentioned that you were able to close your first sales in a couple of weeks. Like, was that part of the reason why people were so interested in it? Because I mean, a lot of times when you talk about climate tech kind of software companies, it's usually not a quick sales process.
Yeah, I mean, I think being able to have customers who are willing to jump on the phone with potential investors and tell them why they love what you're doing. I mean, it's like we all know this is all about product market fit, right? And you know, it's, you don't nail it from day one, you keep iterating. But having customers who can echo that and they're really partners in crime, right? I think much less of our customers as like a static sales pipeline or rows in an Excel, but much more as the people who, you know, for the first couple of years are going to be really critical to developing the right product.
And to clarify, did you say that the lead investors are construction tech investors? They're not focused on climate specifically?
No, they're both prop tech, contact investors. So, that was really important to us. Like, this is we're building a climate solution, but we want people who really know the type of customers and the type of sales cycles and organizations we're selling into. So neither of the two leads are climate focused, but then we have a great couple of climate players on board.
Yeah, I really like this point. This is something that Pale Blue Dot brought up in the past, was that they fund early stage companies, but they make sure that they're regular VC investable later on. And I really like this because a lot of companies, you know, or there's a lot of, I guess, criticism in the market saying, oh, you know, you can't build it. You're only building climate tech companies because there's a lot of money there. And there's just kind of people are just, you know, in an echo chamber. But the reality is that there's actually like, you don't even have to be a climate tech investor to invest this, because this is a perfect example. When people say climate is not a sector, this is the example of building the technology that is not a sector, right? It is a solution that is going to make their lives easier and save them money. And it just happens to be very, very close to helping the climate issue. So I really appreciate that. I guess I think we're pretty much at the end here. We've gone quite over our original time, which I appreciate. I did really want to ask you this. You know, when you look back, you know, 3 or so years, and you kind of made this decision that you wanted to build, and you decided to go into do your master's, and you look at where you are now. Just can you reflect on your initial kind of your thoughts on this past 3 years? Did you think that you would be where you are now 3 years ago? Like, tell us a bit about
that. I mean, it's almost emotional to think about, right? It's how do you will something out of your imagination that you really want to have? And I think for me, building pathways with Alex, with a phenomenal team around me, with brilliant investors and wonderful customers is a dream and a huge privilege that I wake up every morning feeling very grateful for, even on the days when I haven't had enough sleep and you know, there are problems and some kind of tech backend. I did a couple of things that I think of as like really critical steps that led me to where I am today. The first was trying to figure out what could I do that would expand my idea of doing things that felt impossible. Around 2.5 years ago, I was chatting with a good friend of mine, a fellow founder, about what felt truly just impossible to us. We came up with doing an Ironman. That felt really, really impossible. And the next day, we signed up for an Ironman 11 months later, last August. And I think that's one of the critical steps that I took that actually gave me the courage to be a founder, right? Like, make audacious, incredible goals, which completing something like an Ironman for me certainly was. I'd never even run half a marathon beforehand. And then get your head down every single day and do the work, right? 6 a.m., go swimming, go for the long bike rides, go running, do the strength training. Like, it isn't sexy and glamorous. But if you do the work and you keep that big dream out on the horizon, like you wake up one morning and you're in a wetsuit and then in my case, 13 hours and 45 minutes later, you're done, right? And in many ways, kind of that was one of the steps. I did other, that's probably the most symbolic one that really represented knowing that that it could go on the journey of building a company.
Yeah, I love this. I think it's a lot of people, I don't know if I have an opinion on this one way or the next, but a lot of people just assume that, you know, really big time founders who have succeeded are kind of born a certain way. But I don't think that's actually true, because I think people evolve through intention, right? If you look at the lives of people, maybe there's something different about them generally when they're young, but they have to figure out like, hey, I have to find ways to push myself to the next level. I think obviously one of my favorites is Steve Jobs, right? And his like early days, he was an ass, right? He wasn't like somebody who you would say like this person's maybe inspiring in a kind of a weird way, but that he had to evolve to become what he did, right? And I think that's I just really like that perspective that you were able to bring us.
I think what you just said there is really inspiring, right? Which is it isn't something you're born in a certain way. It's something you choose and you work on and you put in the time and the care and the effort. And I guess, I mean, at the element that there's not that many female founders around, like those things certainly make me feel uncertain and worried. And, you know, you look for role models and you look for people who can help you do that. But I think you're absolutely right. It's not like people are made out of something special. It's that they make themselves become something special through intention and through care.
Great. Well, on that note, I think that's a very, very great note to end on. Liza, thanks so much for coming on. Before we close, where can the people find you?
You can find me at pathwaysai.co. Find me on my LinkedIn. Reach out. I love chat. I can chat all day, every day about embodied carbon and everything in between. And we regularly have jobs up. We're expanding our team. We're growing. So check out our site. And thank you so much, guys. I love the platform you guys have created. Everything you put out, your thoughts, your reflections. This has really been such a joyful conversation.
All right, we're due for a part 2.
I can't wait.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye.